Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled. Hi, this is Gianni, and you're listening to Lightmap by Sifter. This is a special episode for you, a panel that we presented at PAX Australia, talking about why Australia is one of the worst places in the world for banning video games. And the reason why that is, well, a really outdated classification system. It is a set of rules that are really narrow, and it means games that previously have been highlighted for their wholesome nature end up getting restricted for sale due to a single instance of player choice to take an illicit drug. It's a really fascinating conversation, and it was a lot of fun to put together. So, let's jump in. I want to begin today by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet and pay respect to elders past and present, and I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders peoples here today, tuning in perhaps all around the world. Today on this panel, which is Why Won't Somebody Think of the Children? Why Australia Bans Video Games for PAX Australia, is Ginny Maxwell, games and digital journalist at Screen Hub, the Saturday Paper, everywhere, and host of ACME's Women and Non-Binary Gamers Club. Hello, Ginny.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
We have Ari Offman, programmer, public programs and curator video games at ACME.
Hi, Gianni.
And Chad Toprak, the director of Free Play and one half of curator duo Hover Garden. Hello, Chad.
Hello.
And my name is Gianfranco Di Giovanni, but you can call me Gianni, and I'm the executive producer of sifter.com.au. What is your favourite game that has been refused classification in Australia?
That's a big call. I can talk about current ones, but there's been plenty throughout the years. Currently, you know, I'm wrapping the t-shirt. Currently, probably my favorite is Sludge Life. I do love it. It is an amazingly fun game. It's got such a great art style. It's got a great sense of humor to it. It was one of those ones I was quite surprised when it was refused classification. If you are interested, you can still pick it up on one of the online storefronts, not Steam, but the other major one. So, yeah. Go check it out.
My favorite would probably have to be Hotline Miami. It's great. I love the fast action, fast paced action kind of vibe to it. The music is fantastic. I'm a big fan of the music, it feels really great to play. And it's just it's weird when it was refused classification when the second one came out, and I think. The first one, I think, had initially received an MA rating, but then was refused classification once it kind of bundled with the second one or something like that. But what's funny is that the developer was just like, you should just pirate the game. Like, I don't really care.
I think mine would definitely be State of Decay, which was given an R18 classification after changing, stimulant drugs to vitamins. It's a zombie survival game that kind of focuses more on community building and resource management combined with the occasional, high energy foray into the zombie infested wilderness. It's that series. Absolutely the best.
And the hundreds of hours that I have in the initially refused classification of Left 4 Dead 2, which was changed for both Australia and Germany, which again has another famously quite strict classification system. We actually went to America in order to buy a copy that wasn't, limited in a way that we came to Australia. So let's take it all the way back to the beginning, because I think most people who've played games in Australia for a while would have come across the situation where one of the favorite games that they're looking forward to, something they're excited for, has come up against the Australian classification system and has come a cropper. Ari, why do we classify games in Australia?
Thanks, Johnny. Yeah, that's a good question. And I suppose what it ties into is the fact that games are viewed as screen media within Australia. So like with all other screen content, whether we're looking at films or television shows, they need to come under the classification system, which means that people are able to make informed choices about what they watch and what they consume. And of course, particularly as it comes to with video games, parents are able to make informed choices about what their kids play and consume. And so look, the way the classification system works, I'm sure most of us will be familiar with the kinds of ratings that we have here in Australia, you know, ranging from G, which is general, and that means sort of suitable for everyone, right up to R-rated content, which is just restricted for people 18 years and older. But I suppose what a lot of people don't understand is the process by which things are classified, and the fact that dependent on the media format and the actual the form of the media that we're consuming, they are actually judged very differently. So when we're talking about classification, there are several things that a classifier and the classification board looks at. And they fall within six categories. So the six things that we look at when you're classifying a video game or any other piece of screen media are violence, sex, language, drug use, nudity, and themes. But more than that, we also look at the way that these classifiable elements are portrayed. And so the second thing that you look at as a classifier the impact that this has. And the impact is looked at in a variety of ways. So specifically, is it a prolonged depiction? So for example, let's say we have a depiction of something violent. Does it occur only for a quick split second and then we cut away? Or is it shown on screen in a graphic and prolonged manner? Also, we look at the sort of realism around it. So again, is it quite a cartoony depiction? Is it comedic in the way that it's done? Or is it, of course, quite serious in the way that things are depicted? Finally, the other thing that is taken into account is the context around why or something is shown. So is the classifiable element, for example, the violence, is it key to the storyline? Is it key to what is being portrayed and the narrative and all that? Or is it something that's shown for more of a gratuitous reason? So all of these things are kind of taken into account. Now, I suppose what we're coming to the crux of today is that video games are classified and judged in a very, very different manner to other screen media formats. And I think that's where our panel wants to delve into.
Right in. Ginny, why is it that you think video games are judged differently when it comes to classifying, unlike a film, unlike other pieces of screen media or movie or anything else we would look at?
Well, I think the first contributing factor is actually in the title of our panel, particularly in the 80s and 90s. In fact, I would say particularly in the 90s, video games were very much thought of as essentially toys, things that were for kids, aspects of play, rather than necessarily having much of a relation to kind of film or television or other screen arts at all. So when games like Mortal Kombat came out that not only depicted violence, but depicted violence with a level of visual clarity that video games hadn't really had access to recently, people were shocked. I think another really significant contributing factor is the satanic panic of the 80s and 90s that saw a lot of kinds of play, including, in fact, most infamously, Dungeons and Dragons, linked spuriously to sort of satanic ritual or other sort of forms of degeneracy or corruption. I think these through lines kind of led to an environment where people saw video games as potentially very harmful to their children and actually harmful to the fabric of society overall.
Now, Chad, a court in the United States wasn't able to do this, but I'm going to ask you to do it. What is a video game, and how do we determine what a video game is if we're going to make a set of rules that applies to video games at whole?
Yeah. Oh, look, I think that's a very tricky question to answer. I don't even know if I want to bother answering it. Like, look, in short, like, video games have a lot to do with rules and systems and structures, interactivity. But I don't think it's my role or responsibility to define what a video game is. I don't think definitions in this context really help, because video games are constantly changing. They're evolving. What a video game is today, like the definition that we come up with today, may not be the case for what it is in 10 years' time. The moment you try and define what a game is, I feel like there are people, there are artists who out there who will try and deconstruct and break those definitions. My favorite way of defining what a game is if the artwork or the game on their website says it's a game, then it's a game.
Where do you see the biggest problem with what we have right now? Well, as you said there, it's a type of interactive experience that is varied. At its core, it's very different. It's individual almost to every player who plays it as well. How can we fix this particular problem? What's the solution? Or where are the major pitfalls with the current classification system that we have?
Yeah. Oh, look, I think it really comes down to context, and it really needs to be handled on a case-by-case basis by a strong and varying panel of people who have those different experiences as well.
I think maybe looking at some historical – oh, yeah, sorry, I thought I was on mute. I think looking at some historical examples kind of really shows it really clearly that the classification board is failing us. When you look at, like, the early – the classification board for – the legislation around classifying games was introduced in 95 and came into effect in 96. And if you look at the games that were banned in 96 – it's sort of a fair cop. I'm not too upset about them. There are titles like a one particularly charming one that I saw that was banned almost immediately. It was called Pawntress. I'll leave it up to your imagination as to what that game entailed. There were quite a lot that seemed to explicitly incentivize sexual violence or sexually inappropriate behavior. It makes sense. In fact, all the early classification requests were brought by the Victoria Police, who are clearly just like, there is a totally unregulated market here for genuinely upsetting stuff. We gotta nip this in the bud. But then fast forward to today, where I know, Gianni, you recently played Lake, a game that was an independent game that was recently streamed as part of Wholesome Direct, that was refused classification in Australia, which really shows that kind of this legislation doesn't fit the way games work now.
Or fit the audiences who are playing these games as well, I think is an important thing, because a game like Lake, which I don't think the creators would be upset about me saying, is a slow game. It's not a high impact, exciting game that's going to be drawing attention from young kids. I really would be surprised if very little kids who would be worried about having sort of impacting sort of behaviors in games, you know, changing what they do in real life, would be really drawn to Lake. But, you know, that's an example where an action done by an adult in the game in the context of what has happened in this narrative thing, because it met the criteria of what the rules said, was not allowed to be, was refused classification.
I just wanted to jump in for a second because I just want Ginny to say something Ginny said before, which is that the classification board is failing us. And I think that's the way that a lot of Australians feel, but I actually think that's a little bit of a misnomer in the sense that the classification board themselves have actually come out and agreed with the statements around it. Like, because they are required from the nature of what their job is to work within the legislation that is set down with them. And I think this is where the real problem comes in, is that the people who are making policy around how these classification decisions that are made, the politicians, et cetera, that are responsible for it, have a complete lack of understanding around video games in general, around the audiences that play them, and around their nature as an art form. And so while working for the classification board, I mean, you are limited to making decisions within legislation. And as you've just mentioned, like with Lake, even they realize like the slightly ridiculous nature over the decision that's had to be made over this really quite wholesome game that honestly like deals with a couple of instances of quite soft drug use, but in a particular way that isn't negative. It doesn't make a judgment on this drug use. It doesn't give you a negative impact within the game, and so therefore comes under instant refused classification status. And I think this brings up this whole thing around context and the way that things are portrayed. And often I think what we find that it's games that are dealing with things in a more mature manner, and there's things that are dealing with them in a more adult manner that often come a cropper. I mean, I suppose one of the ones that we talked about in our pre-chat was Grand Theft Auto, right? And so in Lake, I mean, we've said that there's a couple of references to the use of marijuana in that. You know, it's not portrayed negatively. It's a choice that you can make as a character and things. It's portrayed as a natural part within, you know, this adult interaction, which forms the core gameplay loop in Lake, which brings it under refused classification. Whereas in Grand Theft Auto, you can go and rip a bong and walk around afterwards, but because it slightly affects the way the character walks, it then doesn't fit within the guidelines of being something that is refused classification. And to me, I think that highlights the crux of the issue that we're dealing with again.
Ginny, you've looked into some other examples of notable refused classifications in Australia and some of the potential remedies that people have taken. What are some of the examples that people may have forgotten about in the long history of refusing classification in Australia?
Well, I won't lie. When I was researching this, I got pretty derailed by the existence of Pawntress. took a lot of my attention. But in many cases, particularly recently, games have been reclassified after a dispute from the developer that kind of reframes the way that problematic or like contentious behavior is framed. I think a recent example of that would be Disco Elysium, the final cut, which was refused this year, I think, due to having themes of drug and alcohol abuse. When the classification board kind of reissued their statement and classified the game as 18 plus rather than refused classification, they noted that essentially it's almost a philosophical argument, right? The issue was that there was a character who abused drugs and alcohol, but they decided that overall it didn't actually incentivize or glamorize that behavior, which meant that it could kind of fall under the R18 rating.
Chad and Ari, if people are coming to an event space and you have got games there that you are showing off, can you think about some of the considerations about setting that right context so that the people know what they're coming into and what they're going to expect so you can display things that may not be rated in Australia?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we're hosting public events or festivals or things like Parallels, if we have any games or talks that are kind of sensitive, you just have content warnings or trigger warnings, you know, because a lot of the talks that we feature as part of Free Play or Parallels do tackle themes revolving around death and depression and suicide. And those are very important topics to discuss, and even more so in video games. You know, for us, it's just letting the audience know beforehand, and then the audience able to make that decision for themselves. And, you know, the same goes for a public space or an exhibition. If you are going to have games or content that are sensitive, you either have them placed in a separate room or separate corner that has like very obvious signage saying that, you know, things in this room deal with so-and-so themes. And yeah, and the rest is really up to the audience, you know. I would otherwise not want to censor any interesting games in the potential that, you know, someone might get offended or something like that.
Yeah, because I think what a lot of people don't realise is that there are situations in Australia, organisations and events that can show work that hasn't been through the classification system. With both Chad and I working for one, so both festivals and cultural institutions like ACME, so museums, galleries, can show unclassified works. But what that also means is that we have to have particular training within classifying things in order to show those. And so it actually gives us a few specific categories of classification that we're able to place on things. So again, when, like, for example, I'm exhibiting works that are unclassified, I will actually go through the full proper classification process on that work, the same as if the classification board will do. I'll go through the work and look through it for every classifiable element, and in the end make an informed judgment as to where I think it would fit. So we actually have sort of three classifications that allow us to show, unclassified classifications that allow us to show these works, which is basically a general unclassification, so something that doesn't contain any sort of impactful content. We have an unclassified 15+, so something that would probably fit within the M or the MA rating, or an unclassified 18+. And I agree with Chad. I think it's about allowing people to make informed decisions about the content that they're going to see, that they're going to consume. And that's the key purpose of classification, is that it's not about censorship, it's about informed choice about content.
We touched on this a little bit before, but the talking about the literacy that's required for legislators to work out exactly what a game is and how it works in the context. Is there any positive steps? You've seen any sort of hopeful movements? Because I, like a lot of people, thought when the R18 rating came into Australia that potentially all of our classification problems would be solved.
I think it's a very interesting time politically for games in Australia. There is, I mean, in the last year alone, there has been so, in the last 18 months, there has been a remarkable amount of like legislation and policy introduced around video games. South Australian tax offset, the digital games tax offset that is going to be federally available in 2022. There's so much happening. There's so much interest and politicians on all sides of the political spectrum seem to be interested in talking about video games as a future-proofed industry. Whether this will extend to how we treat games as an artistic medium, though, I'm not so sure. I think, as recently as 2019, Peter Dutton invoked violent video games during the Christchurch terror attack, when it became clear that the terrorist was a white supremacist. He tried to redirect that towards Grand Theft Auto. It's unimaginable.
Okay, just finally, the government and the opposition want social media companies like Facebook and Twitter to do more to stop live streaming of violent attacks such as the one in Christchurch. These platforms say they don't have the technology to do that. I think Facebook took off down 1.2 million copies of that video within the first 24 hours. Do you accept their response?
I accept that they've engaged with us, and they certainly engaged with the federal police immediately. So there's no question about that. The issue is one of timeliness, and if they don't have the technology, and there's a question mark around that, but if they don't have the technology to take it down, then they need to have a serious look at their business model, because at the moment these companies are making literally hundreds of millions of dollars out of people using social media. That's fine, but there is a special responsibility, as broadcasters have special responsibilities and other people that might communicate messages. And in this case, I think they are not living up to the expectation that we have. I think there's a further debate, I might say, in relation to the use of computer games and graphic videos and the way in which that is accessed online. People buying products now, they're downloading products, and these companies have a responsibility in a society like ours to live up to the society expectation.
I think video games can be very politically useful, is what I'm trying to say.
As a matter of fact, look, I mean, as you were mentioning before, satanic panic, moral panics in general, screen media and media of all types have always been a scapegoat for the acts, for the violence, for the things that we see inherently happening within within society. I mean, you can take it back to the earliest form, which is in the 1800s, when murders were occurring, people were blaming it on penny dreadful novels and saying they were going to be the downfall of society. And it's the nature of any new media form when it comes through that it's going to be blamed and misunderstood. The thing that I find potentially interesting, though, is that when looking at video games, they're not a new medium. I mean, there's something now that is, 70, 80 years old if we're taking it back to its earliest form. And I want to jump on to something Ginny just mentioned then, which was sort of Peter Dutton's comments surrounding Grand Theft Auto. And one of the key things he mentioned was about 13-year-old, 12-year-old kids playing this game and the impacts that it would have on them. Now, Grand Theft Auto is an R18 classified game. So by saying that, firstly, I mean, it shows that even our politicians don't really have faith that the classification system is doing what it's supposed to, which is to assist parents in making informed choices. But secondly, I think it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of who video game players are. And let's take that to the awesome research that's done by IGEA. Every few years on the nature of games within the Australian context. And the average age of video game players in Australia currently is 34 years old as of the last piece of research. So when we're talking about, how our kids are going to react to this when talking about video games, again, it's placing them under a context, and it's turning them into a piece of media that is actually not realistic. It's, because it's not the same thing we would say for a film that we're going to see, or a television show that we're going to watch, that we cannot show any adult content because kids might get their hands on it. It's a fundamental misunderstanding on the part of the legislators. Again, there's a really great essay Dan Golding wrote back in 2012, called The Pyrrhic Victory Behind the R18 games rating, which is, look, as a must read for anyone out there. But I think it shows, look, while we have had some progress, the things that he highlighted within this essay are still really well holding. So, okay, I just wanted to give a quick quote from it because I think it kind of sums up what this part of the conversation that we're talking about. Golding says, Australia will get its symbolic R18 rating. However, it's unclear as to whether the cultural importance of this form of art has been impressed upon the halls of power. I suspect it's not. As an R18 rating, as the debate stands, will not also stop sensationalist media attacks on video games and will not bestow any greater cultural legitimacy on the form. I think within the 10 years or almost 10 years since that's written, I don't think we've seen any major shift in the broader understanding of what video games means as an art form, as a medium.
Can you tell us a bit more, Ari, about the background of what that actually means to classify something as R18 as well? Because, you know, from an outsider's perspective, it looked like many things that were previously, and in fact, some things were actually previously MA15, were just immediately moved into the R18 rating with no particular change to what that meant. How does that actually work?
Yeah, it's a good point. So I think one of the major shifts that we have seen is the R18 rating has done quite a bit for the Australian context. I mean, it does mean that some games which were previously immediately refused classification are now able to be classified within Australia. So, I mean, for example, off the top of my head, you know, Mortal Kombat X at around that time was right at around that shifting time between the MA to the R18. And while it was, you know, banned under the MA rating, was allowed under the R18 due to the, you know, the graphic violence that's depicted within. What I find quite interesting and is talking about the nature of interactivity on the impact of the classifiable elements. You know, we've talked quite a bit about Lake already, but I think that's an interesting example. I wouldn't say that Lake is the most interactive of game, although it is interactive, of course. I don't see that the way in control and the character and the decisions necessarily greatly increases the impact of, you know, of the drug use contained therein. I also think, I mean, we're talking quite a bit about banning games and refusing classification. And I think it's important for us to have a little bit of a think about the changing nature of the way that we can consume games and how effectual and how relevant something like refusing a classification still is. So when you just read through the legislation surrounding refusing classification to something, it's still written and it's still written in such a way that that physical media that is requires distribution through a store or through importing is the way that we view things. And so they talk quite significantly that once something is refused classification, that there are significant fines on its importation, etc. However, we all know that that's not the way that most people consume games these days. They're consumed through digital storefronts. They're consumed online. And so what is the end purpose of refusing classification to something? Is it to stop access to it? Is it to make a statement about it? Because I would argue that by refusing classification to something, it may actually be working to the exact opposite purpose that you would have, that you'd intend. By refusing classification to something now, it receives a lot of media about it. Potentially, a lot more people have heard about it now than other like a game like Lake. Right, which is a small indie, quite a wholesome game that may not have got a nationwide audience, is now in everyone's on everyone's radar, and potentially may actually encourage a whole group of people, whether it's kids or not, to play the game. Now, I can't encourage kids to go and play, you know, R18 or a few classification games, but I think we need to think about. Reframing the classification system with the nature of interactive media. Honestly, having people who know more about the medium, about the art form, having being able to inform that process, but also thinking about the nature and the way in which we consume this media now and whether the current classification laws actually still hold validity and serve their purpose.
I went out and immediately bought a copy of Disco Elysium on Steam as soon as they announced that it was going to be refused classification in Australia, because thinking that, you know, the access to that could be limited, but that's not technically the case, is it? There are other alternative ways to get that.
No, absolutely not. I mean, because classification law is enforced on a state-by-state basis, it's extremely difficult for any state to refuse an international entity from distributing something digitally rather than through import, rather than through physical import, that is. And I will say to just back up what both of you said about refusal of classification kind of maybe increasing a bit of hype around a game, I can tell you on the back end, looking at we published a review of Lake for release day on ScreenHub, and I can tell you the number of unique page views on that review, I would say they tripled after the game was refused classification. Suddenly everyone was talking about it. It's a really paradoxical kind of situation.
Is controversy a good sales pitch?
No such thing as bad press, as they say. Also, gamers are a contrarian bunch.
Chad, you work with a lot of different teams to display the work at Free Play, and you know, I think there's maybe an inherent assumption made about the sort of people that make video games. Can you tell us a little bit about like what are the teams like in Australia who could potentially come up against the mechanisms of classification and find themselves on the wrong side of a very expensive decision?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like games are made by a very broad range of demographics. You know, you could be a young kid making games. You could be in your late 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever, you know, making video games. And people who show their games at Free Play are, you know, pretty broad and varied as well. The one really sad aspect of a bunch of these games being refused classification by the board is that a lot of them, you know, they're independent game developers, and a lot of them don't really have the capacity or the people power to deal and grapple with the bureaucracy that's involved with having to send through rebuttals and to chase things up like that. You know, like a huge company like Rockstar can do that no problem. You know, they can hire whole teams to do that for them. But at the end of the day, you know, for independent game developers, what is the human cost of that? And ultimately it often boils down to people not being able to tell their stories, which is rather sad, you know?
Yeah, and I think, Chad, you've hit on a really important point there. Like when we're talking about the nature of, you know, large AAA publishers and things like Rockstar compared to small indie development teams, what a lot of people don't understand is actually the costs of going through the classification process in the first place. Any company that wants to go through the process and have their game released in Australia in a classifiable way actually has to pay for that process. And if it's refused for classification, they then have to pay a significant amount to take it through the review process. And again, while a company like, we'll take it to another famous example, like Bethesda and Fallout 3, you know, with the classic example of Morphine being changed to MedX, you know, a large publisher like that has the time, has the capacity, has the financials behind them to be able to make that change within their game and then submit it for reclassification. Whereas an indie studio really doesn't have the bankroll to be able to make to do that. So it's a system that is unfortunately negatively impacting and weighting advantage towards these major publishers and major development companies, as opposed to like much of the Australian game development scene, indie smaller studios who are telling these stories.
I would even speculate that not only does the current classification legislation affect what games are distributed, I would really speculate that it affects the way Australian game developers approach the kinds of stories they want to tell, knowing that there are such strictures on what is likely to get through and knowing the costs involved.
Have you got any examples that you think of stories that may not be told just because of the potential legislative impact of classification coming down on top of them?
I think probably, I guess an example you could give would be anything surrounding any kind of drug use or alcohol use, because the notoriously the R18 rating is very, very strict on anything that could possibly be seen to incentivize drug use or reward it in any possible way. As I mentioned earlier, even the existence of a character with a patent substance abuse problem was enough to have Disco Elysium, the final cut, immediately refuse classification. But actually, there are lots and lots of stories that should be, like, honestly and thoroughly told for adults, you know, in the appropriate context, that involve substance use, whether that's something as minor as a single instance of marijuana use in Lake to something more complicated and something maybe more personal or dark.
Ari?
Yeah. I wanted to jump off what Judy's saying. Look, because I think everyone here on this panel and I think probably a vast majority of people listening to this would agree that games are an art form that can allow us to explore impactful, real situations in an authentic and an important way. I mean, look, I work for ACME, the Museum of Screen Culture, so I mean, of course I've lived that. I mean, I have a true belief in screen media, like being a form for us to explore stories, to explore issues, to explore themes. So another one that basically would cause instant banning is anything that would deal with sexual violence in a relatively realistic way. Now, look, we're not going to talk about the wide range of games out there that honestly are quite probably offensive to sensibilities. You know, things that the type of content that we don't want. People that support like that yeah that shows this card this content in a well that shows this content in a ridiculous way, but it's also an issue that I think video games can deal with in a mature, a realistic, and an impactful way, like any other screen format. But those kinds of stories aren't I even able to be told within the Australian context because of the instant refusal, and. Again, I suppose what we do is we need to look at this with relation to other screen media forms. Like, these stories can be dealt with within film, they can be dealt with within television, and like these days, even within mainstream television that you see on a major network, in primetime viewing. But for some reason, when it comes to video games, we have these quite clandestine and blanket rules that even with the judging of what context means, and I think we have seen a little bit of progression in there over the years. Look, things can't quite as instantaneous as they used to be, but still, anything that's dealing with these issues is likely to come under the ban hammer pretty quickly.
Do you foresee a situation where a film adaptation or a television series adaptation of a game that could be banned, would it be allowed under Australian classifications because the rules are not applied in the same way?
100%.
Absolutely.
How does that sit with you? I'm really curious about your gut feeling about the way that this is a medium that we spend a lot of time with personally, but how does that actually feel when you can enjoy film, you can enjoy television series, but a game could potentially just be full shy of the rules?
It's so weird. I feel like the blanket acceptance that because it is interactive, that somehow equates to it being more impactful is a total logical fallacy. I think it totally boils down to how the experience is designed and how that's how it's portrayed, how it's consumed, and look, you could have movies that are far more impactful than a video game or even a book. You know, like you could read a book about sensitive topics and get really affected or moved by it, and that would come no way near a video game. And the fact that video games are treated differently in a very blanket way to any other screen-based media is a little worrying, I would say.
Ginny?
I think I totally agree. And I think, you know, the fact, I think it kind of goes back to the fact that at the beginning of this panel, Chad sort of spoke to the fact that it is, and Gianni, you did too, and so did the Epic and Apple judgment, spoke to the fact that we really don't have a clear-cut definition of what constitutes a video game. And it is because the field is so varied. I don't think there is, even with the best intentions, I don't think there is a single set of legislation that could apply to everything that counts, kind of, that counts or could count under that banner. In fact, in terms of video game kind of rulings, one thing I found very exciting, just for a bit of context, the Epic versus Apple lawsuit recently had a judgment, and in that judgment, the court sort of discussed the fact that neither party had actually offered an adequate explanation of what a video game is, and then offered one of their own. But what they also did is reduce the terms of that particular court case from discussing video games broadly to specifically discussing digital app-based gaming microtransactions, thereby making a very, very specific call about what ways their judgment was actionable. And I want to see more of that. I want to see more of that. I would love for there to be more classification conversation about how we can make these guidelines more useful and more reflective of the diversity of the medium, rather than trying to create kind of a large banner that fits and everything underneath it.
Yeah, oh, look, agreed. I was going to talk about some things, and then Judy's just said some things in there that's made me think. Like, I suppose what concerns me is that we have actually seen some progression in the content that is shown within video games. But really, what we're only seeing it particularly within what I would argue is one area, and that's within violence. You know, games that we see now are far more graphically violent than we would have seen 10, 15 years ago. And part of that's to do with the progression of the medium itself and, you know, its ability to show those things. But we don't seem to have an issue. And I suppose that, like, my question to the audience, to everyone, is what does this say about our social mores as a society, where we are more okay for a game to be rated MA-15 where you can kill people in a graphic manner, but you can't show a realistic conversation about a social issue that faces us all? Because, I mean, part about where this panel came from, like when we were all having these initial discussions, was, and I mean, it's not a game that's banned, but it's after I played Life is Strange 2 late last year, which is rated R in this country. And I think it's a great game. It's mature. It deals with quite significant issues. But because there is, a segment in there that deals with drugs, the drug use in a relatively realistic manner, it's rated R. Now, personally, you know, I don't have kids, but if I was to have teenagers, I would far more rather than like them exploring the issues and exploring things that are dealt with in something like Life is Strange 2, then, I mean, you know, look, I don't have an issue jumping into a game and shooting a bunch of zombies if that's what you feel like doing too. But I think it really speaks to, and maybe that raises concerns about where our social mores and our social values are coming from, and what we see is acceptable within screen culture and what is not. Also, I just wanted to quickly, I think some of the most important legislation that needs to be looked at are these evolving things that are happening within games that aren't currently covered. Microtransactions, loot boxes, all of that. That to me is far more worrying than whether someone's going to smoke a joint in a game.
That was something we touched on in the discussion of this as well, is that online interactivity between different players is a realm that is not even attempted to be classified in most circumstances, because it is such an interactive thing, and you can't control what's happening on the other end of the microphone. But should we be controlling what's happening on the other end of the microphone?
I mean, my opinion is a resounding yes. I think that social platforms of all kinds have responsibility to moderate the actions of their players. And I think I'll keep this brief because otherwise I'll go for a really long time. I also think that it's really absurd that a platform can develop a reputation for threats of violence, and particularly sexual violence, that don't impact and other kinds of language that would, if included in the game in any capacity, would be an instant refusal of classification. They can just platform that language over the course of years and have absolutely no ramification on the perceived social impact of that game in terms of how it's classified.
Yeah, I totally agree. My nephews, like who are 13 and 9, have been quite obsessed with Fortnite for a while now. I got no issue with Fortnite as a game. Look, I mean, personally, it's not my thing, but I'm not going to sit here and slay the game. But what I am going to have an issue with is the degeneration in the way that I see them interacting with people because of that, the toxic culture that comes through because of that. And even now, when playing a one-player game, I watch, my 9-year-old nephew, and, the things that come out of his mouth, are quite concerning. And you're right, what responsibility, does a platform have for the content and the interactions that are taking place within that platform?
There has been a little bit of movement and was touched on before. They're talking about loot boxes, about randomized chance. They're kind of called gacha mechanics. They're a big part of games like, not so much Fortnite, but other games as well. Like, this is the way that games pay for themselves to be made now. The one-off purchase is pretty much the method of the past in a lot of circumstances. Is that something that should be controlled with a rating system in Australia?
Yes.
Why?
Absolutely. Why? Because, being honest, they are specifically designed in a way to trigger responses within users. And the thing is, when you're older, you can make a bit more of an informed decision. And even when you're past it, lots of people who are older fall prey to that as well. But the flashing colors, the particular sounds that happen in a certain way, they are triggered to have those core sensorial responses that bring, the release of dopamine, which then may which again triggers the continual reuse of this. Now, to me, I think that's pretty insidious. Like the fact that they're using the research in order to, basically in order to create something that is addictive and then charging again and again for it. And being honest, making the people who are more vulnerable in society prey to it, that to me is really concerning.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. It's extremely dangerous. And the fact that there's active research that goes towards how to incentivize players to spend that money is very concerning. There's a whole website dedicated to these types of designs called dark pattern designs. It boils down all the way to where they where they place certain buttons, what color they are, what shape they are, putting into account where your thumb lies, and accidental misclicks incentivizing you, taking you to a store page or whatever. A lot of that, I think, is extremely dangerous. And like Ari said, I think the most vulnerable in the population are the ones that, end up being manipulated. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think there needs to be some legislation that looks into and looks after that area.
What do you rate the chances that we'll start to see a better, more nuanced, intelligent rating system that applies in Australia in the near future? Is it a pipe dream? Is it something that's being worked on? Where do you think we're at right now?
Well, I mean, there was the call for action that came out, was it a year ago or so, 2 years, that was asking for everyone within the games community to feed into changes within legislation. And I know that a paper has come out of that, but I haven't actually seen, like, too many of the changes, like, in fact, really any of the effective changes in legislation surrounding games come out of it. So the likelihood of it, look, I think we are on the road to it, because, again, the average age of gamers is going up and will continue to go up. Like, but I don't think it's going to be a quick process. I think that we need to continue having these discussions about it, you know, fighting the good fight and, you know, supporting this medium that we all love.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I feel hopeful. I think we have a very strong young generation of artists and game makers who are coming up, who are, you know, who feel passionate about the art form that they work in. And as, you know, federal and state government pays more and more attention to video games, I feel like those conversations will organically happen. And if they don't organically happen, we have organizations in Australia who will knock on the doors of certain people and get those conversations happening. Like Ari said, I think it's important that we continue to have these conversations, that organizations like ACME and Free Play and Arts Hub and Screen Hub continue to provide space for these conversations to take place. And it's not something that's going to happen straight away, but I feel hopeful that it will get better. I hope that it's sooner rather than later.
I think I take a little bit of a less optimistic view. Just seeing the way that kind of the dialogue around games and the political sphere in particular has focused so heavily on games as like an export product and as a marketable product, and rather than as an art form, you know, I think really that's where the kind of dominant mindset around games is, rather than around their like cultural impact. And I think combined with the fact that, as we discussed earlier, refusal of classification doesn't really hugely affect a lot of the sales of games, actually, apart from Australian-made games, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see classification legislation sort of ossify and be pushed to the side for a few years. But I really, really hope Chad and Ari are right and that I'm wrong.
Just before we finish as well, I wanted to give a big shout out to one of my favorite online resources that's been going for years and years that has been fighting the good fight with classification. It's called refuseclassification.com. It's one of the best resources that you can get about classification decisions here in Australia. And it's far easier to actually find out the reasons behind decisions than it is through the classification board website. So, yeah, just I'd love to give a shout out to the great work that they've been doing for years.
And I just want to give a shout out to Alex Walker and the team at Kotaku Australia, who have done some really excellent reporting over the years on the perpetual issue that is classification. If you want to find out a bit more about the history, you can go to Kotaku Australia to find out some more. That is pretty much all the time we have for this particular panel. Chad, do you have a closing comment for us?
Yeah, no, I wanted to give a shout out to an exhibition actually that I co-curated alongside Amani Nassim and Harry Lee Shanglun. We worked on an exhibition in 2015 called Play is Evil that actually grapples with a lot of these themes, you know, themes around torture, death, capitalism, love, existentialism, and you know, we it wasn't limited to just video games. We actually had physical games. We had like slapping games and things like that. And it was just to show, just to have that conversation and that dialogue. You know, we had games by Robert Yang that dealt with themes around sex. We also had, you know, Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto there alongside games like Candy Crush and Cookie Clicker. I think it's really important to allow our audiences to experience those things and come to their own conclusions.
Well, Ginny, Chad, Ari, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for discussing in an intelligent adult way about how we should approach classification in Australia, with some hopes for the future, maybe some not as hopeful for the future as well. It's been a real pleasure talking to you all. Thank you for being part of this PAX Online panel at this Melbourne International Games Week.
Thanks, Gianni.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
That was Won't Someone Think of the Children, Why Australia Bans Games, which went... broadcast live as part of the PAX Australia 2021. You can check out a video version of that story if you'd like to watch that and see some of the games that we featured or talked about in that podcast. That's on our website, sifter.com.au. Sifter is produced by Scott Quigg, Sarah Ireland, Fiona Bartholomaeus, Daniel Ang, Adam Christou. Mitch Lowe is our senior producer, and my name is Gianni Giovanni. I'm the executive producer. If you like the show, give us a follow. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. And tell a mate if you reckon they'd enjoy it too. Well, it's one of the best free things you can do to support us. If you'd like to chuck a bit of money our way, we've got a brand new store where you can pick up Sifter unique designs inspired by classic video games. That is at sifter.store. Search for that. You can find a whole bunch of different designs, some really, really cool ones, and more are always coming along the pipeline as well. That's sifter.store. While you're online, come join us in our community on Discord. You can be part of the conversation there. Share the work that you are doing. Share the cool creative projects you're working on. We'd love to see things in progress. It's one of our favorite stuff. And meet a really nice group of people who are just really very supportive. To join our Discord, you can head to sifter.com.au/Discord. That address again, sifter.com.au/Discord. We've got heaps more on our website, sifter.com.au. Heaps of interviews that have just been featured as part of the Sifter Showcase. They're now making their way onto the website, so you can check them out at your leisure. Lots of video interviews with teams all around the country who are putting in a lot of hard work for some lot of cool games. So that's sifter.com.au. That's all for this episode. Until next time, have fun. If you like insightful discussions about those high-profile games that everyone's talking about, then why not check out Sifter's other podcast, Mainstream, in your podcast feed right now. We talk about those high-profile titles, those AAAs, some of those other smaller indie darlings, featuring insights from the award-winning Sifter team and other special guests. You can find Mainstream in your podcast player. That's on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or head to the Sifter website. That's sifter.com.au.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator Hironobu Sakaguchi made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. At sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.